prophets like Isaiah are not the most polite people in the world. In the Bible, their preaching always brings a bit of a jolt. And they don't speak, you know, in lovely, warm, brown tones with the risk of people nodding off. On the contrary, their job is to kind of shake people and wake them up to reality. Because if people don't wake up and see reality and therefore change their direction of travel, well, then there's going to be a disaster. That's why the prophet preaches. There's something urgent that needs to be declared. I once heard a story. There was a guy who was driving in the middle of the night outside LA. And it was an area with a lot of bridges. And on this particular night, there was an earthquake. And he pulled over and waited for the earthquake to end. And when it was over, he was back on the road. And he said he could see the taillights of the car in front. And it was a good bit ahead, but he noticed that very suddenly the lights just disappeared. And he knew that was weird, so he stopped his car and he got out and he discovered that one of the sections of the bridge had completely fallen away. It had just bottomed out. And he realized then that the car in front had, of course, just driven right off the bridge. And then he turns around and he sees some other cars heading his way, unaware, of course, that part of the bridge was missing. And so, you know, he starts waving his arms and trying to flag down the cars. But it's the middle of the night. And who's going to stop for a weird guy at the side of the road waving at you in the middle of the night? And he said he watched four cars go past him at 70 miles an hour. And each driver plunging to their death. And then he saw a bus coming. And he decided that if that bus went over the edge, it was going to take him with it. He was really determined. He took off his shirt and he starts going frantic. And he's waving his arms like a frenzied madman in the middle of the road. And the bus is flashing its lights and, you know, sounding its horn. But this guy is determined to get in the way. And thankfully it works. And this time the driver stops and gets out and like, what is your problem? And then he sees how close he was to driving off the bridge. And with the bus and this guy's car, they go nose to tail and they cross the road and they block it off so that no one else can pass. In a way, that's what a prophet does. They're not very polite. They want to wake us up to reality so that we will make the right response urgently. Now, it might be good news. Prophets brought a lot of good news. Prophets in the Bible don't just talk about impending doom or disaster. They also, their job is to bring hope. But again, it's all about waking people up to reality. So a prophet might say, listen, I know that all you can see is doom and gloom in your circumstances right now, but I'm telling you, there is light on the horizon. The sun is going to rise, and there's going to be a new day, and it's going to be so good you'll not even believe it. So don't despair. There's a great example of that in a song that we sometimes sing from Isaiah 52, which is, you know that one, awake, awake, O Zion? Awake, awake, O Zion, and clothe yourself with strength. Put on your garments, Isaiah says in Isaiah 52, put on your garments of splendor, O Jerusalem, the holy city. The uncircumcised and defiled, that is, your enemies who have subdued you and have oppressed you, they will not enter you again. So shake off your dust. Rise up and sit enthroned, O Jerusalem. Free yourself from the chains on your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. That's chapter 52. So, you know, prophets in the Bible, they want to wake us up to the hope that we cannot see. And that's why Isaiah is such a great book. I know it's pretty intimidating, it's big, and we're not familiar with the historical context of Isaiah's day, so it's a wee bit off-putting, and we can feel a wee bit lost when we're reading Isaiah. But, you know, well, I know, I'm sure I'm not the first person to open the book and start reading a bit of Isaiah and then think, yeah, I think I'll just read the Gospel of Mark again, or dare I say, just Facebook or something. We tend to revert to what is familiar. But I want to say that Isaiah is worth getting into, primarily because it opens our eyes to see the awesome greatness of God, the reality of who God is, and how we can trust him. Isaiah wants to right-size God again. And maybe it is true that our God is too small. Maybe our God is too small. Maybe if we really believed that he was incomparably and gloriously almighty to fulfill every one of his promises, almighty to take hopeless and screwed up sinners like me and bring forgiveness and renewal so that one day we'd be fit to live with God in his glorious presence forever. If I could grasp how powerful he is to do that, I'd pray more, I'd worry less, I'd have greater boldness to live for him, whatever the cost. What I need on a regular basis, and what Isaiah would say we all need, is to wake up to the reality of how incomparably great and powerful God is. In Isaiah's day, there seemed to be only one great power, and it seemed to be invincible, and it seemed to be terrifying, and that was namely Assyria. The Assyrians, we're talking the latter half of the 8th century BC. The Assyrians were getting more and more powerful in the region. They posed a massive threat, both to the northern kingdom of Israel and to the southern kingdom of Judah. Remember, the people of God in those days had been split into two after the days of David and Solomon. And there was the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And Isaiah was at work in the south, in Judah. But in 722, the northern kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians. And 2 Kings 17 tells the story. And Isaiah knew that the Assyrians weren't going to stop there. I mean, if they had ravaged and defeated the northern kingdom of Israel, they're going to hit Judah as well. They're going to try to take Judah too. It was a period of immense political upheaval, and right across the ancient Near East, the Assyrians were on the rise. And for many people, they simply could not see past the Assyrians. Maybe today there's something that you can't see past. It's too big. Maybe there's some insurmountable problem or sin or guilt or trouble in your life. Maybe it's a crisis of faith or an illness or something ahead of you that you really don't want to face. Maybe a challenge that you have to deal with in your own family or at work, and you cannot see past it because it's too big. Maybe it even threatens to derail your hopes and your plans and your dreams. Certainly as a church, we can feel that way. We can feel overwhelmed by the tide of secularism, for example. We're small. Our wider church up and down the land is in decline. We're at risk of being in decline. We're losing young people. Our faith is ridiculed. And maybe it's really hard to see past the challenges that we face as a church. When that happens, whether in your own life or as a church family, the question is, what will we put our trust in and where will we look for help? Some might say we just need better methods, better strategies. To whom or to what are we going to turn? The temptation for Judah was to try to save herself, trusting in diplomacy, trusting in alliances, resting on her own political wisdom, relying on shrewd policies to preserve Judah's status and security. And really, we're still the same, aren't we? We're so easily tempted to be self-reliant. Now, of course, there are always common sense things that we could do and should do. But the most important thing that we need to do is to depend on God. I mentioned that the prophets don't tend to be the most polite. So if I dare to try to paraphrase Isaiah in this book, he basically says to the people of Judah, "What are you, nuts? You're not seriously going to rely on yourself, are you? Don't you know the God to whom you belong? Why on earth would you try to save yourself when you can call upon the Almighty to deliver you? Did not the Lord God Almighty promise himself to you to be your Redeemer? Have you forgotten your own story? Isaiah would tell them. This is the big message. We haven't got into chapter 13, but giving a general big message of this section. Did not the Lord your God bring you out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm? Did he not promise to bring about a great inheritance for his people? Can any power compare to his almighty power? Can anyone get in his way and prevent his purposes? That's in part how Isaiah preached. He wanted them to look squarely in the face of their enemy, the seemingly invincible and terrifying Assyrian Empire. And then he would say, the nations are but a drop in the bucket to the Lord God Almighty. Chapter 40, verse 15. They're not worth fearing. I used to be embarrassed walking my dog sometimes. When I was a teenager, we had this big golden retriever, not unlike the one we have now. And it always feared other dogs that were absolutely not worth fearing. You know, occasionally when walking past a tiny, I don't know, Jack Russell dog, no offense to Jack Russell owners, but my big dog would cower in fear. And I'd be like, no, you know, you've got it all wrong. That is not a dog worth fearing. And if you're going to cower in the corner like a pathetic weasel, you know, please let it be in front of a scary looking Great Dane or a Rottweiler or something. But don't be scared of that. In Isaiah's day, nations like Assyria really did seem utterly terrifying. They were big, they were scary, and yet, compared to God, they were nothing. Like Isaiah said, to whom will you compare God? And that's what a prophet does. They take all the things that people fear, all the powers and ideologies that seem ultimate, all the forces of this world, all the movements that seem unstoppable, and the prophet says, really? You're going to bow to that? Are you insane? There's a healthy disrespect for anything and everything that would be seen as ultimate. And it might be something we fear, and it might be something we live for, or maybe it's something that we feel defines us and that we must follow. But Isaiah and all the prophets in the Bible would say that if it's anything other than the true and living God revealed to us in Jesus Christ, then the prophet would say, you've got to be kidding me. Like I said, this is just a general intro to the whole section of chapters 13 to 26. And I want to cover it in another four sermons. But you know, we read chapter 13 today, and let me just briefly draw attention to a few details. It begins an oracle concerning Babylon. Babylon was a very important city for the Assyrian Empire. In days to come, following the Assyrians, the Babylonians would rise to power. But you know, this oracle against Babylon and the following nine other oracles against other nations through to chapter 23, they remind us that every nation on the planet, every power on the planet is subject to God's judgment and therefore is not ultimate. No matter how big, no matter how scary, no matter how powerful they appear to be, no matter how much we can't see past the problem, the reality of what they are, they're not ultimate. And we need to right-size God in order to get a right perspective. In verses 2 to 5, the Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. Babylon is going to fall, and the judgment is inescapable precisely because it is the work of God himself. And the point is that Babylon is not worth fearing. There's no one and nothing to fear except God alone. He will put away every rival power, every enemy. So for you and me and for the church, the point is that whatever we are facing, we can say with Paul, if God is for us, who can be against us? He's going to put every enemy under his feet. Cancer will be destroyed. Poverty will be destroyed. Loneliness will be destroyed. Corruption will be destroyed. Sin and death itself will be destroyed. And yes, every power like Babylon that does not submit to the only Lord and judge of all will be destroyed. All hands in Babylon will go limp, verse 7. Every man's heart will melt. Babylon is not worth fearing, but God is. Babylon will be no more. That's verses 1 to 8. And then we get verses 9 to 22, which explain why God is going to pour out his wrath on Babylon. Look at verse 11. He says, I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless. God will simply not allow human arrogance to flourish for very long. And that's because human arrogance cannot coexist with the glory of God. The glory of God is the glory of his righteousness and his purity and his love, and that makes him angry. Of course it makes him angry. At the arrogance of those who think they can treat people any way they like. Do you see the end of verse 13? It refers to the day of the burning anger of the Lord Almighty. Now, I know, you know, we read this. I know that, of course, people don't like to hear about God's anger. But really, what would you prefer? Would you prefer a God who did not care in the face of evil? Would you worship a God who is not even angry when people commit evil? What sort of a God will be indifferent to wickedness and evil? Certainly not a God who is holy and worthy of our praise. The love and the goodness of God is absolutely meaningless if he has no anger in the face of evil. And therefore the rest of the chapter shows that Babylon's destruction at the hands of the Medes will be complete. In the sovereignty of God, and this is a bit head-wrecking, but we see in this chapter that in the sovereignty of God, he will even use wicked nations to bring devastation to other wicked nations. Thankfully, there's the other side of the coin, though. In chapter 14, verses 1 to 2, we finished with those two verses at the beginning of chapter 14, which reminds us that the Lord will have compassion on his people, not because they're better, not because they're wiser and humbler and nicer. The only reason is because God is faithful. He promised he would have a people for himself to live with him under his blessing forever and ever, and he will. Not only the Jews, but Gentiles 2, verse 1. That's why it says aliens. Aliens will join together. It doesn't mean extraterrestrial beings, but it does mean foreigners. It means not only Jews, but Gentiles as well. It means you and me. It means us. We are the fulfillment of chapter 14, verse 1. Joined together into the people of God to enjoy his salvation, ultimately through faith in the Messiah who would come, Jesus Christ. He died, of course. We were reminding ourselves in the words of the Catechism just a short time ago that he died so that God's righteous anger and wrath towards sinners like us would be turned away and poured out on Christ in our place. He had to die so that we could be forgiven, and so that we in turn might know the opposite of his wrath, his life, his glory, his presence. May God help us to right-size him again today, that we might not fear anyone or anything. And may God help us to depend on him in every trial, in every challenge, in every test, whether as individuals or whether as a church. Let's depend on God. Let's right-size him. Let's fear no one and nothing but him. And let's cry out to him, knowing that he is the Lord and the Judge of all.